Okay, thanks, Kunal. I guess I kind of gave a short version of this to Robin before he left, and he suggested I focus on the topology part of this. So there are kind of two parts of this, and I'll try to just give the topology part. I've cut this, and if there's kind of time, I'll touch about some stuff at the end here related to ensembles. But there's two slides of very general, the backdrop of what we're trying to do. In the Holy Grail, one of the Holy Grail, say, granular statics is to be able to specify the preparation. That means the grain sizes, the shapes, and interactions. And we know the preparation histories also. We kind of specify that in kind of in a gross way. But we want to be able to predict macroscopic properties, such as the constitutive laws, whether it's what type of continuum even it should be described by, whether it's elastic or something else, and also things like yield, which depend on the stress distribution. Now, kind of in this program, I think many of us are, yesterday when we were introducing ourselves, many of us said we're interested in statistical mechanics of granular materials, and I think kind of subconsciously at least we're motivated by the success of statistical mechanics in thermal systems, and we're kind of hoping those type of ideas might yield some benefit looking at granular systems. Now, kind of in pursuit of this grail, Holy Grail, going from, say, the contact network to the constitutive behavior, there's kind of been a class of ideas that have come up in relation to force chains, and I want to bring this up because even though we didn't go in looking for force chains, they came out of the topological analysis that I'll talk about. And I just want to highlight kind of two features. One is, this is a slide taken, a clip from Bob Berenger's website showing, I think maybe even Josh showed this in his talk yesterday, showing the type of force homogeneities that you're all familiar with now, and they have this exponential distribution at the large forces. I think what spurred a lot of theoretical effort also was kind of the apparent initial success of the Q model, which gave an exponential tail by saying it was a lattice model where the load on one bead in this lattice was randomly distributed between left and right legs here. And this was kind of random thing, kind of reshuffling of this total load. Now that gave this exponential behavior, but it was phenomenological, and I think the initial dissatisfaction was with the fact that it's a lattice, there's no vector component to it. Later on, there are vector models added, and I would sort of view the model that Josh gave yesterday was it's kind of descendant of this type of philosophy. And I'd say it's phenomenological because as far as I know, all the attempts to generalize this have put in guesses of what that redistribution should be. You know, the two legs, someone asked should it be three legs, you know, when I hit something, maybe that force is spread out among three contacts. Josh's model, all the models I've seen, all the redistributions are compressive. They're also always pointing down, they're never pointing back up. And I think part of that is motivated by theoretical convenience. It's easier to write than kind of direction of force propagation. So we'll kind of examine these assumptions in the analysis that we carry out. Okay. Another area then that will come up in our analysis is, we'll have something to say about this, the constitutive behavior. There's kind of a debate on whether if I take a block of granular material like this, should I consider that to be elastic, having kind of that by load, the stress appears everywhere, or maybe rather hyperbolic, and in many kind of soil mechanics constitutive laws, they're more like this, where I have a failure point and I don't have stress over there. And I would say that in this whole story, probably what I feel is missing mostly is where is the grain contact information? And that's kind of what we targeted. Okay. So in this program, going from the microscopic looking at grain size, I kind of break it down, the statistical mechanical programming, in two steps. First, the mechanics. So looking at the mechanics of in the static stresses in granular systems. And we just picked a well-defined subset of granular statics, which is these piles of frictional star disks, which has been discussed to be isostatic. And what we'll see in our analysis is that there's a force chain hierarchy or directed topology controlling the way the force is propagated. And we'll look at what the implications of that are. That was done primarily by my master's student, Yui Kangsadan, who's in King Mongkut University now in Thailand. And this is the part which I probably won't have time to get to, but given kind of mechanics, we can start then taking ensemble averages. If we can translate, what this will allow us to do is take geometry and translate that to mechanics. And if we define how piles are made, with a given ensemble, we can take averages. And Lots of questions like, what, you know, average force scattering, whether fluctuations, correlations. Okay, so first, really talking about mechanics. All right, so we start off with kind of, I try to pick a well-defined test system, and our basic model is hard frictionless particles. And we choose an ensemble, and I think the choice of ensemble actually played a critical role in discovering the topological character in the force chain network. First of all, we have actually ambient load. So these are not just particles floating in a space shuttle. And so what that means is that there's gravity, there's confinement, for instance. That's the case that we look at. But that's not, the analysis is not restricted to that. But the basic thing is there's some kind of ambient load which is holding the pack together. Okay? And secondly, there's an explicit boundary. So it's not just periodic boundary conditions that kind of go off to infinity, because boundary conditions actually be important in characterizing topology. I'll review just a minute what we need to know about isocyte packing to understand this, and then we'll examine the force response function. Okay, so here's a quick review of the salient points for isostatic packings. So isostatic means that if I have a contact network, I have the minimum number of contacts to provide rigidity. So Corey's graph he showed were, if you use different size particles, they would always basically be isostatic. That's a claim. The second thing is that when it's isostatic, this minimum contact network also guarantees that any applied stress is uniquely resolved in terms of contact geometry. One thing to particularly take note of is that what's called the Maxwell Kimona count is satisfied. What that means is that because it's rigid, that means I don't have anybody floating around. So the number of degrees of freedom is the number of constraints, the number of contacts, is equal to at least greater than equal to the number of degrees of freedom. And the fact it's isostatic, we're saying it's a minimum number, therefore we say it's equal to the number of degrees of freedom. As I said, if we assume these disks are random size, which is this case that we're studying, the probability of accidental extra contacts is zero. So sometimes if you have extra contacts, sometimes that's called hyperstatic. I'll just say that this claim is related to a theorem for isostatic graphs that if you have generic lengths between, and if I were to draw the contact network here and make the lengths generic, then in fact you can prove that they're infinitesimally rigid and that the set where I have degenerate contacts is a set of measure zero. It seems to be, it's not quite the same thing as saying you have random sized disks, but probably close. So one thing to remember is that the number of contacts, the number of bonds, is equal to twice the number of particles.
So rigidity here is not just a macroscopic measure. You're saying nobody moves.
Nobody moves, right. And part of, and I think, you know, if we have gravity, then we don't have really a situation of Radlers, for instance. And the other thing is, you know, here I drew kind of a flat box, but if this box, so what I'm trying to do is take out all the possible sources of degeneracy, like if the box were slightly wiggly or crooked, then I wouldn't have balls that could roll on the bottom without potential change either.
You say with gravity you can't have a rattler, but yeah. You can certainly have a sort of arch below which the particle is rests on just two.
That's right, and that I would consider to be a rigid system.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's, okay. And I'll just say that there's actually, I would just point people also, there's a lot been done on rigidity theory by Bob Connelly and Walter Whiteley. They wrote a couple of nice reviews about 10 years ago, I think, that appeared in the mathematical literature. Okay, so this kind of maybe clarifies a little bit what I mean by the type of packs I'm looking at. So I pour the particles into a bucket, and they settle down to a minimum potential. And the claim is that there's positive curvature as long as I don't have some sort of accidental degeneracy. Okay, so I don't have any, so I'm not looking at you know, faceted particles which happen to be flat and can slide like that. So everybody, any type of motion, I'm moving up the potential energy in configuration space. So in this type of situation, the response function is well-defined, and there is a linear, there's a regime of linear response. It might be small, but the width of the linear response regime depends on things like the stiffness of the particle, the degree of ambient loading, the size of the system.
So, yes. I thought I understood that there was some sort of, or perhaps the same theorem you mentioned before, that says that if you were isostatic, then the thing diverged.
What diverged?
Some susceptibility, some response function.
Yes, it could. Okay, there are certain things, for instance, Whitney and Pacheco looked at, and also recently, I guess, I can't remember, there's a... yes, Mukarzel also looked at the response function in terms of, say, how far does something move, how far away does something move, and that goes like the system size. Yeah. So that's possible the linear response function is going to be over a long range. Now, there are a couple of things. One is there's a mechanical response. What I'm focusing is going to be on the stress response. Okay. One other thing is I just want to emphasize that this model accommodates larger scenarios. It accommodates some degree of softness. As long as, being a little bit soft, as long as the number of contacts doesn't change, it's essentially the same model. I push on a little bit. The whole network might deform a little bit, but the lowest order, I just get the hard disk response function. And it accommodates things like adhesion. So if I have a kind of an attraction between particles, I could turn this thing upside down, and if I probe what the linear response is, it's the same as well.
So U in this case is simply gravity?
So it's some potential that's holding it in its minimum. And for all the cases that I really look at, you can think of it as gravity holding the grains in a bucket. Okay. So here's kind of a schematic. I press somewhere on this particle, and what I'm doing is I'm looking at the incremental change in the stresses everywhere. And because these are frictionless, these stresses are all scalars, and they're looking at the increase or decrease in compression on every bond in this contact network. Okay, so what we really have is kind of a glorified freshman mechanics problem, in that if I, for instance, I've had two disks like this, and I have gravity acting on everybody, and then I ask, I just want to have force balance on every particle. I just look at the x and y components. It's one big kind of linear system. And I can basically then represent this as kind of a matrix equation where I take all these coefficients which encode the contact geometry, so in other words, what particles touching what, and also the angles. These are all the scalar stresses, and at equilibrium with no external force, then we just have this relationship here. And because it's isostatic, this is a square matrix. Remember, let me just back up here. So we said that the number of constraints, which would be the number of equations, equals the number of degrees of freedom, which would be the number of scalar compressions. So because of that, I have a square matrix. And therefore, this says that at rest, there's no extra loading on the bonds other than the ambient load. Okay. So then I can ask what happens if I press on one of these particles. So I just add an extra scalar. I can press here in some direction. And I basically get the same type of equation. I'm kind of just putting this up here, not going to read through this, but just kind of give you flavor for the plausibility. When you work through to calculate what the response function is, it's actually just the inverse of this connectivity matrix, or this rigidity matrix. Okay, so for instance, how would I read this off? These would be the columns here give me the response to pressing, say, on the x or the y direction, x direction of particle 1 or 2, y direction of particle 1 or 2. So if I press on one of these, I just read off this column and it says, for instance, if I were to press, this is particle 2 in the x direction, then only this bond gets stressed. If I press on particle 2 in the downwards direction, then only this bond gets stressed. The other ones don't get changed. Okay. Basically you can read off what the response functions are. Let me see here. Now here's where we actually found, this is where we found something interesting. I'd say this is really the heart of the analysis here. So what we notice is that if we look at this response function, for instance, just for this two-particle system, if I were to press, for instance, directly on this particle towards this particle, what I find is that this bond is not stressed, this bond is not, it does not change its stress, but only these two do. Even if I were to press directly in this direction. And it doesn't really matter which direction I press it on. Okay, so kind of at first blush that might be a little bit counterintuitive, but really that's no different than the scenario where you have, say, this pointer on my hand. This is resting on the table. If I were to press up on my hand, I would leave the amount of normal force that the table needs to provide, but the stress between the pointer and my hand does not change. That's really the same situation that's going on here. Now, one thing to note is that this is not... So I kind of write down this... I kind of picture, depict that information by drawing two red arrows here. What that means is that if I press on this particle, only these two bonds will change their stress.
Okay?
And not this one. So now it goes this way. I only follow the arrows out. If I press on this particle, on the other hand, we will... this bond will change stress, this one also, but of course this one is pressing on this one, so kind of in a recursive way, this will now activate stress changes in these two bonds. So I have kind of a hierarchy of force response. Okay, where this particle only affects these two, and this one affects all of them. Okay, so one thing to notice, this is not related to gravity. Okay, so this is not, it's not directly related to gravity, it's related, once you have the packing in place, I could turn, as I said, if there's adhesion, I could turn this upside down and press up or sideways or down, I would still get this kind of directed topology.
If friction into the works, that would no longer be true. Because I could have a restoring, like a force in the vertical direction when I...
Yeah.
Is that true?
What would happen in friction, if I had, if these two were actually frictional, what would happen is it wouldn't be isostatic. And so we would not have a well, we would not actually have a well-defined response function that's just a function of the contacts.
Can you press in other places? You're only pressing at the center of the particle? Can you press like contacts with the wall or something?
Right now I'm assuming there's no rotation degree freedom. So I can apply it, you know, in actuality I can apply in different places, but I'm only looking at the center mass force. Okay, well, this idea, basically, you can kind of keep going with this. You can run with the same idea recursively. So, for instance, if I create a path like this, I can interrogate what the response functions are, and I find that there's a, again, a sequential hierarchy of rigidity. So, the way this map works, and it's, and I left one off here, if I press here, if I press on this particle, what I'll find is that this bond and this bond and this bond and that bond change their stress, but none of the others do. Okay, and one way to think about that is that if I go back to this original picture, part of this is this where, you know, where did this directionality come from? It's related to the boundary condition. So in other words, the boundary is providing whatever, the boundary contact is defined to provide whatever normal force is necessary to stabilize this. Because it has that flexibility, this is always going to be changed before the other ones do, okay, because it's isostatic. So what that means is that before I, if I'm trying to topologically analyze the rigidity here, I actually don't need to know what's going on with the rest of the graph to know that these two bonds actually go outward from this particle to the boundary, same here. And because of that, then I can recursively look at this one and say, well, this one's touching this one, which was rigidified by the boundary, and if I can draw a bond this way and this way, and I can keep going like that. Okay? So once I decide this one's rigidified by the boundary, I can kind of consider this to be part of my growing boundary in terms of analyzing the rigidity. Okay, so I left off one of those, and this is just kind of a quiz here. So here I can draw these arrows in this way. So this, based on what I'm saying, this bottom has an arrow on it, and either goes to the right or to the left. So, so how many people think it's going to the right here? How many people think it's going to the left?
Yeah,
it's not. Okay. Yeah, I actually cut out a few slides here. It's been into 30 minutes, so I usually have a couple more slides of explanation. Okay, so let me kind of interpret that for you. If the bond is going this way, what that means is that if I press here, this bond will change the stress, and it'll percolate through, but it will not change the stress if I press on this particle. Whereas if the arrow is going from right to left, it says that this bond will change the stress if I press on this particle, but not if I press on that particle. Okay, so kind of based on that, yeah. So the question is, which of these particles do I need to press on in order to change the stress on the song?
Is there an arrow for that?
Yes, there is an arrow. That's not a trick question. Okay, how many people think to the right? Okay. More people. How many people think to the left? Okay.
Just this
is my vote. It's mostly a class. Actually, it actually does go to the right. And here's a little key to kind of recognizing that. There's one is that if I press on a particle, okay, in order for force sounds to be achieved, I need to have enough contacts, enough outgoing bonds to change the stress in order to compensate for the additional load. Okay, so if I press on this one, I cannot actually have only this contact change stress. Because I would only be able to do that if I press straight along this direction. Okay. If I press off an angle, then I have no way of resolving the component in this direction. So I need to have this one change. If I press on this part, both of these have to change. Okay. So what that one thing that tells us actually each particle has to have at least two outgoing bonds.
Is that a restriction to get to press downwards?
No, it has nothing to do with which direction you press. I could press this way or this way.
So the angle between the two points is less than 90 degrees. Mm-hmm. Press it upwards, so there's a tensile
moment. There's a tensile, that's right. But the reason why it sounds not intuitive is because you don't really have if you're just talking about hard disk under gravity in a bucket, you don't have tension occurring, all you have is decompression. So there's an ambient load. So for instance in this case, this is sitting on those two, if I press up, like you said, here's this an angle less than 90 degrees. All that means is that decompression in these two bonds.
Assuming it's already sufficiently
stressed,
right.
It's all infinitesimal force.
Yeah, we're just looking at the linear response. It's a finite interval, but it could be it's small. So right now we're just looking at that limit. Okay. So you know every particle has at least two outgoing bonds. And what's great is that the Maxwell Kimona count told us that their total of two n bonds, and what that tells you therefore is that every particle has exactly two outgoing bonds. It couldn't have more because then some other particles would be left out of the game. So if you look at this graph, for instance, a particle could have multiple coordination number, you could have four or three, but the point is that only two will be special. Okay, everyone else feeds in to the particle. Okay, well that's great because what that means is you have exactly two outgoing bonds, then you basically have a unique way to specify the way force is resolved at a particle. Okay, so force comes in, it has several contacts, the two are special, which are the ones that rigidify that particle. And so this force gets resolved along those two directions. Okay? And it just kind of iterates through the path that way. Okay, so here's kind of an example. So here what we did was we actually numerically tossed a bunch of particles up into a tall box, let them fall down, let them settle. Okay, so this is the path that came out. And here's kind of a conventional force chain picture. We have force and homogeneities. And basically what we're adding to this picture then is that if you actually take the trouble to topologically analyze that force chain network, you'll see that there's actually an underlying directed graph for that force chain network. Okay. So how do you read this? What this says is you just read it the same way as before. If I were to press on, say, this particle, I know that these two bonds are stressed, and therefore I'm pressing on these two particles. This one now has these two outgoing bonds, and I just follow this kind of iterative, I just follow these one-way streets, these bifurcating one-way streets all the way down. Now this is not a tree, I'll just notice that this is, as a graph, it's not a tree because you can have, for instance, this one touches this one touches that one, they both converge back on this node. So it's directed, but it's not a tree. Okay, so here's an instance of that. If I press here, this is the case I press straight down. Here's the change in the stress. So this is the force response, the stress response, I guess you call it. And you can see that there are several qualitative things to notice about this. One is that I have compressive regions, and I also have decompressive regions. Okay, so this is type of arching. I press here, even though I'm pressing down, because of the geometry, more of the load is being taken up kind of in an arching sense along this red-yellow line. And therefore, some of the vertical load is taken off of the bottom layer. Okay, so this shows that actually, if you're trying to understand force transmission, actually, you need to take into account, if you want to do it this is an exact analysis for the tacking. You have actually decompressive responses, not just compressive responses. Another thing to notice is that you actually have upgoing. It's not, the slope is not very high here, but you have also upward traveling responses as well. So it's not just kind of a one-dimensional thing.
Okay. It never linked back to the sieve, to the top, because the top is not rigidified.
But no, the whole thing is rigidified. This whole thing is rigidified. The reason why you can never loop back is because it's directed.
Yeah.
So here's another example. If I press on this particle, only this part will actually change its stress. And none of this will. So notice that this is actually, it's kind of a microscopic manifestation of, or microscopic version of the hyperbolic behavior that you expect, where if you press somewhere on the system, the stress response is only in a localized region. So these you can always think of as characteristics. And here there's no perturbation. Okay. And so here's another example. We press here, and then these are the ones that change their stress. Okay. Now, what I showed you is kind of an argument for how you could build the rigidity, but I didn't show that it captures every type of graph, every type of packing. And so I just want to talk a little bit about doing a rigidity analysis of contact graphs for a moment. So first of all, in two dimensions, there's a Lamb's theorem, which is a combinatorial way to look at a graph and just determine whether it's rigid or not. So the statement is simply, if I look at a graph, the contact graph, every subgraph has to have less than or equal to 2n minus 3 edges. So it's basically saying every subgraph is more or less has the minimum number of bonds to make it rigid. Every bit. So I don't have too many bonds in one spot and too few in another. Now it turns out there's another, n is the number of particles. And the reason why, when you look at a graph floating in space, why I have this minus 3 is that accounts for the translation, the rigid body motions in two dimensions. Okay. Now it turns out there's another version of the Lamb theorem, which is related to what are called Hennenberg operations, Hennenberg constructions. It says that every Lamb graph, every isostatic rigid graph, can be inductively constructed from two types of vertex additions, type 1 and type 2. And I'll show you what those two are here. So here, for instance, imagine this is already a rigid graph. Okay, this part's already rigid. I can actually, or say, an isostatic graph. So these mean points maybe connect to the rest of the rigid cluster. You can actually then look to see if I can add a vertex here, another particle which touches this particle and that particle, and this is rigid. And this is kind of a trivial case because if this is rigid, the triangle is kind of the minimal rigid unit in the plane, so this whole thing is rigid as well. Okay. Now it turns out that there's another type of way to create a rigid contact. Is I can actually imagine if I take this particle and I contact these two, but suppose I push a little harder and it actually breaks that contact apart, so this contact fails. And what happens? This will just keep moving until it contacts another one, say this one here, and this whole graph then becomes isostatic also. Okay. Now if you look at this, it turns out that this is very similar to what I was able to do before to look at the directed network. Okay, so I just basically keep adding particles which recursively or iteratively depend on the previously identified particles. So if I look at these two types of steps, what I find out is that, okay, if I were to draw the directed network again, this one has to depend, if I press on this one, since these were already previously identified to the boundary, I know that the arrows must point along these two legs here. Okay. But in this type 2 step, I've actually ruptured this one. Now what I find is that there are three of these bonds I can no longer assign a directionality to. Okay, some of these survive. For instance, because this is rigidified and this was rigidified by these two legs, this is still part of the boundary. So then I know that this one must rely on this, because if I press on this, it's only got to go on these two and not on that one. So I can still draw this arrow, and actually I can make this one changes. I can't identify this one, but this one I can maintain. But if you look at what this is, what's happening here, what I have is I have three particles, which is a rigid group, okay? And this rigid subgroup of the entire graph is actually connected all by directed bonds. Okay, but now it's three bonds rather than two. And that's actually what you expect, because to rigidify a particle, I only need two bonds for the x and y directions. But if it's a, if I have a rigid group that can move like this, I need three bonds to stabilize where it is and also keep it from rotating. So what I have basically is, I kind of generalize this. So before I had a particle which is rigidified by two legs, now I have a triangle which is rigidified by three legs. So this triangle is an irreducible rigid group. Okay. So basically it's kind of the same story, but now the force propagation, instead of proceeding from point to point, now can, if I have force coming into this triangle, this triangle stress, but then the triangle, in order to maintain equilibrium, it propagates as force along these three vectors. Okay. I'll just point out though that Hedberg construction is not, it's not a unique decomposition of the graph. So what you could do, for instance, here's another, this is actually a very similar situation before, this is the original isostatic graph. Here, this is another isostatic graph, and I could do type 1 and type 2 just like before. It turns out in this case, using a type 2 graph on here does not actually spoil the directness of the bonds here. And that's because even though this was constructed, this can be constructed by a type 2 step, I could have constructed this by a sequence of triangles here, like that, to also give me, just as a sequence of type 1 steps, I can also maintain the directness of the graph. Okay.
Sorry, could you back up just one?
One.
Can't you also uniquely identify the directness from that, you have these two dashed lines, you know that one arrow right below where you showed, right, you have one arrow going out.
So this is, these dashed lines are actually bidirectional.
You could have either one go out.
Yeah.
And still satisfy.
Right.
All right.
Right. And so basically what happens is when you press on a triangle, it will sustain internal stress. In fact, you can show that one of these has to be tensile or decompressive. But basically, you press on a triangle, it feels some internal stress. At the same time, it's supported by three legs, and those three legs propagate the net stress on the triangle. Okay. So what can we find? So really, basically we can do, we can decompose the rigidity of an overall packing into irreducible rigid subgroups, and they can either be particles, which are vertices, or groups of particles, and you can think of those, I guess, as hypervertices. And what we find is that in our gravity-settled piles, I think this is kind of the curious thing, that only type 1 steps are needed in the vast majority of packings that we found for Hedberg, in terms of Hedberg decomposition. So for instance, when we pour piles like I showed you, very few of them require, occasionally we do find a little triangle, which is the irreducible subgraph. But for the most part, we find that they're just individual particles.
So you can uniquely determine the directed graph?
So one thing I just say is that I kind of went through a kind of graphical analysis of the network, but another way to do it, a brute force way to do it, is you just take the connectivity matrix and take inverse, and you just read down what the response functions are. And what you do is you just look to see which ones are subgraphs of the other ones. And so there is a unique directed subgraph. There's always a unique topological decomposition of rigidity. And what we're finding is if they're single particles, then if they're single particles, every bond is directed. If I have like a triangle, then I don't know the stress necessarily inside the triangle, but I know that force is propagating in a unique way coming through that triangle. Okay. So now these are isostatic. What are the isostatic graphs? Now I think this actually provides an interesting way also to analyze non-isostatic graphs as you move away from the isostatic point. So there's been some work, people looking at elastic graphs and gradually cutting bonds and going from the elastic limit. But I think there's actually some insight to be had from looking at going towards the elastic limit from the isostatic case. So here's a one-dimensional version of an isostatic package. So I've got three particles in a row, and I've got six contacts. Now, either what I could have is I could have compression. So for instance, in some simulations, you create packings by compressing on different sides. And every time you compress, you actually have seven contacts, so this is not isostatic. And you can see the force response function is not determinant. If I were to press on this middle particle, for instance, in this direction, depending on the rigidity of the particles, if this particle is hard, then what that means is most of that stress will be taken up on this side. Okay. However, if this is soft, this will give, and what will happen is instead, when this one is stiff, then actually I'll have a decompression on that side. So what you find is that when you have extra contacts, there's a degree of freedom which depends on microscopic variables like the stiffnesses. And then what happens is they appear one at a time, basically. So if you kind of analyze what the response is, so you have one extra contact now, and you have the same 3 degrees of freedom, and so this constraint matrix is no longer square. You have one, the kernel has dimension one, rank one, and that degree of freedom is an elastic mode, because what that is, that just corresponds to the net compression of the entire system. Okay. So what you see is you actually see every time you add a contact, you get an extra elastic mode. This elastic mode, which is compression all along this line, it's just a linear combination of the left-going isostatic response and the right-going isostatic response. So what happens is that the elastic modes appear as linear superpositions of these directed response functions in the isostatic case. And as you add more and more extra contacts, you go more and more towards the elastic limit. I mean, you know, for instance, that if you do, if you look at like a set of balls and springs and they're connected into kind of a, just like when you're doing continuum homogenization, if you have just, you're trying to rubber stamp a model, say a rubber, you can kind of get the continuum that way. And those are always basically tend to be overbonded relative to isostatic. And so those have an elastic continuum limit, and this basically provides kind of a mechanism by which you can get to that elastic limit, starting from the isostatic hyperbolic limit. Okay, so fusions, these isostatic response functions have a hierarchical topology that depends only on the packing. You can identify this hierarchy recursively by building from the boundary, and that's where the directedness comes in. When these irreducible groups are a single particle, the force changes are all directional. A boundary plays a role, and I just compare this with kind of the advanced neutral Green's functions. So basically, the material may be homogeneous. If you looked at a periodic, if you did a simulation and you looked at a periodic isostatic system, and you press, you don't really know which way the response is going to go. But because of the boundary conditions, that distinguishes which Green's functions are going to use. Okay. Now every particle has exactly 2 outgoing bonds, and I just emphasize that. When I said it in type 1, if I have single particle position, that corresponds to single sequential deposition. So one thing that tells you is sequential deposition always has perfect directed graphs. The surprise thing that we found is that our particles fell down, sloshed around the collective motions, but it's still assign a directed graph to that. Okay, so what are some of the consequences? So first of all, because they're 2 outgoing bonds, I can analyze this now as force propagation occurring as a series of scattering events. Now this results in a non-phenomenological P-model or Boltzmann equation that depends on outgoing pair geometries. Okay, so I think one of the nice things here is that up to now, all these types of force propagation models you've kind of put in guesses, and this puts it tells you exactly what the scattering function is. It's related to finding what those 2 special legs are on each particle. The other thing to notice, though, is that it's the response functions and not the force chains, which are the sum of its response functions, which are the fundamental quantity in scattering theory. So I contrast this to, say, Josh's theory yesterday, where in Josh's theory, the force chain, the total amount of stress is kind of splitting up. And there's still conservation law, so you can create a theory like what Josh did, but what we find is when we do an exact micromechanical analysis of these packs, that wouldn't actually work. Because it's actually the individual response functions which satisfy this Boltzmann equation. We found out that the stress field is localized and directed, so that's a signature of hypervalency. And also that the stress intrinsically related to extra contacts corresponds to appearance of elastic modes. Now, one other thing is that I believe this also provides a mechanism for explaining why, if you look at that, if you look at the exponential tail in the force distribution, that actually disappears when you go towards elastic material. And what happens then is what we've seen is that as we go to a plastic material, we're basically linearly superimposing these isostatic responses by some random amount, which depends on local thickness and local coefficients. So what we have, we can think of this as a sum of random amplitudes of these isostatic responses, each one of which is exponential, plus and minus. But if you add those all together, then this will, and if it's random, then you will go to a Gaussian distribution of forces, which is what's seen in elastic movement. Okay, so I gave this presentation to Matthew Turner, and then he kind of smirked the whole way through, and then he led me to the room next door, and he showed me this. I had to take a picture of it. But I kind of put this up because I guess in discussions with some of you, the question arose of what would be experiments to do to kind of go along these lines. And I try to think of a few. One is, I think, in general, it may be fruitful to look at, to do the topological analysis of contact networks in different experimental paths, to see whether, you know, regions which are overbounded or not. Of course, if the particles are hard enough, it should be isostatic. If they get squishier, you'll start to have extra contact. So you still may be able to do the topological analysis. I think another interesting thing would be to look at this transition from a hyperbolic material to an elastic material as increasing the number of contacts with compression or softness. So a signature of that would be, in addition to the overall constituent behavior, you might be able to detect that in the change in the force distribution. And I think maybe the last thing is, it may be able to directly measure the force scattering kernel. In other words, what is, if with an incoming force on a particle, I can measure what is that kernel which tells how that force gets split on a given particle. And we may be able to relate that, the correlation length in the scattering, to topological features. Okay, well, I guess that's pretty much it. I'll just say one thing. I'll just tell you what we did. We just made a pile. We specified a way to make a pile, and this was, we just made them almost all the same size. We poured them in, and we measured the response functions numerically, and we did the Boltzmann equation analysis, and this is the numerical results, and we did the Boltzmann equation. So we just kind of propagate this. It turned out that it didn't work. And I'll say the reason is, what I think is happening is that one thing that Boltzmann equation leaves out is that the Boltzmann equation is basically a sequence of uncorrelated scattering. But what we find here is that because it's basically like a pachinko ball, which is rolling down these one-way streets, but the pachinko machine is always the same for a given path. So if the force propagates this way and it comes back and comes here, it needs to know that it's hitting the same sort of scattering center. So you can do a quench average, we ensemble average over pachinko machines, but what you find is that if you do the real average, when we compare that Boltzmann equation result to the numerical results, it didn't seem to work. So this is something we don't know how to do this correlated Boltzmann equation on a quench disorder. Okay, so I think I'll just stop there, and thanks for your attention.
With respect to physical experiments, how much does a little bit of friction destroy what you said?
Oh, that's a good question. And I think this is an area Robin Ball and Rafi Blumenfeld have looked at a little bit more, which is the question of how close isostatic can get with frictional packs. And I think their claim is that you can actually get pretty close if you prepare it in a very fluffy way. And the thing is, the thing with frictional packs, I think you can never quite get exactly on, because there's certain, just like in the Tomasolzi's pointed out in the ball and the groove, when you look at just simple frictional contacts, you always have this stress indeterminacy. Now, that's not necessarily that bad, because certain stress indeterminacies are localized. So, you know, the fact that I might have a little rigid cluster where that tells me the stress, it's under stress in this little area, but it may not affect the overall propagation. But I think it's kind of an open question. I think the other way to proceed with these in terms of Boltzmann equations is that even when you go through the elastic limit, it depends on things like the stiffnesses. So if you're trying to build a theory for understanding stress propagation, you're doing an ensemble average over those stiffnesses. So one way to handle those frictional cases is to say that interdependency is also another microscopic variable which has a certain distribution. So I'd probably go those few routes.
Actually, let me make a quick comment about experiments that I'll show tomorrow. Yeah. But the mean contact number, we can get down to around 3.1.
Okay.
And still have a robust network by doing the right things.
Okay.
And it's an apparent Z, so you mean, I'll qualify a little bit, but
okay.
You'll get pretty close, I think.
Okay.
So you might have said it and I missed it. What is the relation between these linear response networks and the actual force propagation networks that are already there in the system, which is
loaded
with mass of it?
Okay. So basically, like, if you want to look at this picture here, if you look at this picture, so this is kind of the ambient load, and this arises, since we have gravity, basically, this is the load on the gravity, and that arises, you can reconstruct this picture by taking this graph and applying the weight of each particle as an external force on each particle. I didn't say that in the clearest way, but what I could do is I know that if I take the weight of this particle, I press here on this particle downwards, that'll create some sort of force response. And if I do that for every particle and add them all together, then I just get the picture, the previous picture.
So those particles on top, you cannot exert the force in the opposite direction, right? Because there's no mass. The mass is very small right at the top. So there's very little decompression.
That's right. So in terms of actually the limit of linear stability, these would be lower. The limit here would be reached sooner than down here.
So maybe a slightly dumb question, but I mean, suppose I looked in your next bottom layer.
Yeah.
And then I tried to do a force response not on a top particle but on a buried particle.
Uh-huh.
So then presumably, even though your network all points down,
yeah.
If I push down that particle, I mean, so then I see no response above, or what would I expect?
Yeah, so like if I press here, I think I had a case like that. If I press on this one. So this, when it's isostatic, you should see no change in the stress anywhere here.
So in some sense, that makes a nice test of how
They don't change.
Are these arrows line up with the gradient of the stress essentially then? So that makes sense.
The gradient of the stress as well? Well, they're kind of, I'd say they're kind of controlled, in this case, they're kind of controlled by the boundaries.
Because it's gravitating from the gradients, the stress is all going towards the boundary.
Yes, the downward boundaries. I think we actually measured the stresses and we didn't see significant gradients in this direction.
So you see the bottom layer that is entirely left-directed.
That's right.
Arrows there and then on the right, just because there's one particle in the middle
that's
sitting on the bottom.
Right. Yeah.
Do you notice any width or height dependence in various things in the network or in the response?
We haven't systematically studied that. So
I mean, it's making it very tall and very wide and then looking in the middle.
We haven't gone large enough that we feel that we've gone away from boundary effects or to kind of systematically explore that. So yeah, I don't really know, because right now this is kind of flowing towards the boundary, so at some point for the direct network to sustain itself, it's kind of that information needs to propagate from boundary all the way to the middle. So I don't know how that happens if we haven't done big enough systems.
Okay, I think we should close the session and just end.